This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Stugatz, I meant to compliment you from a couple of days ago. I was sort of reminded of it now as the show opened with you turning the word fraudulently into Fraggle Rock. Your ending of the show a couple of days ago, for what we do, for what our audience wants, is perfect in that we were talking to Jorge Masvidal. I asked a sensitive question. We botched the total ending of the show. It sounded like Jorge Masvidal, the ex-baddest MF-er in UFC, was mad at the interview. And just your last words were an echoing sort of, I was afraid that was going to happen. So we sat down with Masvidal. I want to talk about that at some point because I'm in an uncomfortable spot as it regards his politics and everything else around him as he comes home back to Miami and our allegiances with him. But I'll talk about that in a second because Roy was here when we did the interview with Masvidal, and we'll put it out next week at some point. And there's going to be some stuff in there that people don't like that is going to bother people. So I want to talk to you about that in a second. But the first thing I want to talk to you about today is, I don't know, you know how much I like to talk about journalism. I don't know exactly where we are right now in the Washington story of the Washington football team, because nothing in the mainstream is being reported, but the internet is giving a lot of details on things that are speculation, and it's wild speculation. And the starting point is mainstream media members have picked up that the reports that the Washington Post is working on some sort of big story. Now, there's a lot of garbage around this football team. Daniel Snyder has been a disaster the entire time that he's been there. People leave there and they tell you it is the most dysfunctional place in the world. They lose leadership people. And so recently, after decades of being strident about his nickname, he totally caved. And this happened after some minority owners, Stugatz. And this one's important. This part of the story is important. Minority owners looking to bail on Washington football, according to report, that is something you do not see in that sport, because what happens with minority owners in that sport is they get into the first part of the club, and it's how you get in line to become an owner later. And so people want in on that club. And so the idea that these minority owners, like, I'll be interested to see if a Washington Post story does come out about bad details on the Washington football team. I will be interested to watch, did these minority owners on their way out because they couldn't, like, buy the team? Did they have anything to do with the latest details? Did they leave because of the latest details in this Washington Post story that's allegedly coming? But when I say allegedly, Stugatz, have you heard any of the details? Because you could check the internet. It's rumor. It's gossip. It's innuendo. It's the only thing that seems as reported fact is the Washington Post is working on something explosive. That seems to be the only thing that we actually know. I don't want to speculate actually beyond that, except as it relates to the reported facts we know that are fair, which is the minority owners leaving there and that being sort of a damning indictment of, hey, what's coming next? Because minority owners don't leave in that sport.
Well, to your point, it is such a difficult club to get into, especially if you're a minority and you have minority owners who are, I don't know any of the details, but you have minority owners who are in the club who are trying to climb up the ladder within that club, and now they might be prepared to bail because the circumstances around the franchise that they have ownership in is so bad. I am interested from a journalistic standpoint, when someone is investigating your organization, your company, the last word you want to hear is explosive.
Okay.
That is bad.
Yeah. Well, here's where we are with this, okay? Just so that people can understand the journalism of it, which is interesting to me, but I understand how it is that the walls have caved in on all this stuff between who's doing credible reporting, who's not doing credible reporting. This extends well beyond sports. This is something that has fallen in the last 15 to 20 years as the internet exploded. What ended up happening, Stugatz, is the serious news voice got diluted by everyone having a little bit of a voice. And now where we are is that journalism has all but tumbled, except for in a couple of places where the traditional newspapers that are big and can afford to be owned by Bezos, in this example, where they can actually do some of the substantive work that isn't gossip, innuendo. Like, this is the thing that scares me about the way the media is dying, Stugatz, and that we've entrusted billionaires like Buffett and Bezos to keep it alive. That the responsibility of the Washington Post in this instance, before they print this story, this thing has to be vetted so much that the reason that you're probably hearing that it hasn't come out yet is because they're probably very close on the story, but it has to go through so many lawyers and so it has to go through such a filter. I don't feel like people know this about the media. I'm not even sure that they care anymore. But as we sit here in America and we can argue about facts. I can give you a fact and you can tell me it's not a fact, okay? I can give you science and you tell me it's not science. Like, that's what, as we're arguing about that stuff, it's important for the audience to know that whatever's being whispered out there about this story right now, I know that's the juicy stuff. I know that's what you want us to talk about. I know that that's the stuff that you want the details on. But to me, the more interesting part of this, as it relates journalistically, is the Washington Post will absolutely not run this story, Stugatz, unless they've got it totally nailed. They are one of the few news outlets still out there doing it that way as news falls apart because everybody is diluting this stuff with their voices. And so if the Washington Post does have a story, this used to happen sometimes with Sports Illustrated, Stugatz, you'd hear they're investigating a program. There's a story coming. And then you'd never see it again. It wouldn't actually come. So I don't know what is going to happen here. But if some of the details are right about what is happening there and the mess at the top is so bad that the worst franchise you've ever seen is somehow even worse than you thought it was, what's going to fall on Dan Snyder's head is going to be really, really unpleasant because this guy, who's been incompetent for a long time running that team, has felt so emboldened with his rich guy FU power that he has run it into the ground through a series of mismanagements, couldn't make Spurrier win, couldn't make Joe Gibbs win, couldn't even make the guys who we know to be competent as coaches win.
Nobody's won. And by the way, the worst franchise in sports is the New York Jets. So just so we're very clear on that. It seems like in the overall, though, from a journalistic standpoint, you are yearning for the days where everyone would do it the way the Washington Post is doing it right now.
It's just fairer, Stugatz. It's not even that I'm yearning for it because the day is dead. And not only is it dead, but people want the other stuff. Like, that TMZ has flourished for a reason. Like, people, like the gulf between just social media commentary, TMZ, and real journalism in perception is smaller than it's ever been because there's any number of things you read on the internet, you don't care how credible the source is. Like, we know that Adrian Wojnarowski and Schefter, if they're reporting something, we know because of their credibility that it must be something that is close to happening. Somehow they are rarely, rarely wrong on the news front. But how many distinctions are being made as it comes to news, Stugatz? You were way ahead of the curve on this. You 15 years ago, I remember mocking you because I'm like, what's the source on that? And you know what stupidity I would do? This is 15 years ago. You'd say, I don't know, this place called Bleacher Report. And my response was, what the hell is that? And now look at what Bleacher Report is. Like, what is that thing? That thing's not credible. That's just some website that you found. Bleacher Report, what the hell's that? The Washington Post, if they are indeed working on something big, if any of the details you're reading about whispered on the internet, it's going to be super messy. It's going to be one of the big football scandals.
ESPN Radio is presented by Progressive Insurance. Progressive's Home Quote Explorer is changing the way you buy home insurance. Now you can go online, get a custom quote, save both time and money. You could do it all at progressive.com.
We have not done a good enough job around here talking about the controversy involving the anti-Semitism of DeSean Jackson and Steven Jackson, so we will do a better job when Dave Zirin joins us in about 10 to 12 minutes to talk about a story that is usually, I would say, probably pretty poorly reported when it makes its way into sports. And so we will talk to Dave Zirin in a second. But before we do that, Stugatz, what I wanted to tell you about this alleged Washington Post story, and I'm in a nebulous area here, Stugatz, because we're in this land, this purgatory between explosive gossiped info and ESPN as a credible news outlet not being able to report or verify or give credence to any of the things being whispered about. This is the internet space that people love because it's social media irresponsible. You could say whatever you want on the internet about what you think is happening, but major news organizations have a standard to get this stuff into print.
Thank you for explaining what a nebulous position is, because until you did, I had no idea what you meant. So.
Okay, so you're welcome. And all I wanted to say on this subject before leaving it alone is that this stuff is hard to get printed. But one of the things that I find fascinating about what might happen next with the Washington football team, Stugatz, is I want to know who is upset. Like, who is doing this? Who is putting out the information? And what is the motive on doing it? Because I thought when Washington changed its name as a football team, it was such an about-face from a guy who was so strident that it made me wonder, what else is here? Is it just sponsors coming after him? Or is it others as well? So I want to read to you something the New York Times reported a couple of years ago. Juliet McCoy, she's excellent and has been excellent for a long time. She reported a story, and it makes me wonder, because of this story, if this story can be linked to whatever it is happening with the Washington football team. But before I get to that story, there are many people writing in, and they think, and I'm inclined to believe them, that you thought minority owners were minorities. That when we were discussing this in the last segment, you didn't think that minority owners meant they had a smaller percentage of the team. You thought I meant minorities, or you were just covering your bases. Maybe you thought it was both. Roy, did you think that Stugatz thought that minority owners meant owners who were minorities?
Absolutely. I think he thought that Fred Smith is a minority.
Okay. Hold on, Stugatz. You'll get to defend yourself in a second. I see you in a real defensive posture. Just hold on.
I'm not in any sort of defensive posture. I mean, it's funny, actually.
All right. Chris, do you believe that Stugatz knew that he was saying minority owners and that he thought it was owners who were minorities?
No shot.
Okay. You don't think there's any shot whatsoever that he thought that perhaps there were Hispanic, Native American, black minority owners with the Washington football team?
I'm saying that there's no shot that he... I think you are spot on, Dan. There's no shot that he knew you were talking.
Okay. Do you know how poor you have to be at communication in two words to say something that means the opposite of how I took it? This is how poor a communicator you are. You had two words. One would have helped. You said no shot. All you did was confuse everybody. Christ almighty,
I mean,
man.
Even I was confused. I didn't know if he was siding with me, with you.
How could you be worse than that in two words? Like, it's not possible to be... Tony.
Bald eagles.
Tony, what did Stugatz mean? What did you think he meant when we were talking about it?
He definitely meant he thought that there was some minority owners that may be non-white. I think that's what he meant.
Billy, is it a consensus around here, or are you going to defend Stugatz?
I'm going to defend Stugatz. I feel like he needs someone in his corner for moral support. Even if I don't necessarily believe that, I'm just going to, you know, our guy needs support. He's taking a lot of punches today.
All right. But I want to say, though, you know, when he does this move right here, this is the Stugatz tell, the rubbing of the left arm to soothe himself. It is a soothing gesture, and he does it all the time when he's in a weakened position. I want an honest answer, the first one in your life, Stugatz. Did you think that the Washington owners we were talking about were minorities and not smaller percentage owners?
I was rubbing my right arm, which means so you're seeing me opposite today because you're looking directly at me. I was not rubbing the left arm. If I was rubbing the left arm, I would fully admit to you I thought they were actual minorities. But since I was rubbing the right arm, that means I'm extremely confident in what I'm about to say. Billy, you were right in defending me. I was talking about minority owners, owners that don't have as big a stake as Daniel Snyder in the Washington football team.
All right. It's unfortunate. I believe you. I think the lie would have been funnier, but I actually believe you. So here is the story, though, from the New York Times. And again, it's hard to get these things published. They go through a vetting process that is very stringent to avoid lawsuits. Many lawyers look at this stuff. So when this got into the New York Times, this is a credible bit of reporting, Stugatz, and she writes, when the Washington football team took their cheerleading squad to Costa Rica in 2013 for a calendar photo shoot, the first cause for concern among the cheerleaders came when officials collected their passports upon arrival at the resort, depriving them of their official identification. For the photo shoot at the adults-only Occidental Grand Papagayo, I don't know, resort on Culebra Bay, some of the cheerleaders said they were required to be topless, though the photographers used for the calendar would not show nudity. Others wore nothing but body paint. Given the resort's secluded setting, such revealing poses would not have been a concern for the women, except that the team had invited spectators. A contingent of sponsors and FedEx suite holders, all men, were granted up-close access to the photo shoots. One evening, at the end of a 14-hour day that included posing and dance practices, the squad's director told 9 of the 36 cheerleaders their work was not done. They had a special assignment for the night. Some of the male sponsors had picked them to be personal escorts at a nightclub. Quote, so go get back to your room and get ready, the director told them. Several of them began to cry. Quote, they weren't putting a gun to our heads, but it was mandatory for us to go, one of the cheerleaders said. We weren't asked, we were told. Other girls were devastated because we knew exactly what she was doing. Now, I don't want to speculate any more beyond what it is that's been reported that is vetted and factual. But I wonder, Stugatz, and to me, the next interesting piece to drop on this thing, if it makes its way from the internet into the mainstream newspapers, is this is happening because blank. Like, it's not just the details that might be appalling. I don't have them in front of me now, but like, who is at the forefront of basically, you don't get NFL owners going down, Stugatz. They don't go down very much. And if this story is explosive enough, there might be some danger for Dan Snyder. So Nick Cannon was wilding out, and he did some anti-Semitic things, some hateful things, said them. He has apologized. I don't know if he's lost his job with The Masked Singer, but he's losing other jobs. And it was just flatly anti-Semitic what it is he was saying. And so I wanted to talk to Dave Zirin of The Nation, because Dwayne Wade found himself in stepping in it yesterday, where he tweeted out support of Nick Cannon at a time that you can't really support Nick Cannon. And so he apologized for it and tried to clarify it. It runs against what Dwayne Wade normally seems to run against. But Dave Zirin is with us now, so we could talk about all this stuff a little more intelligently. He wrote something for The Nation on this. He's the sports editor of The Nation. So thank you for joining us. I guess let's start here. As it regards DeSean Jackson and Steven Jackson, given that you specifically, with what you write, usually align yourself with people like them, to hear them be anti-Semitic landed on you how?
Like a thud on the back of the neck. I mean, completely disheartening for several reasons. First and foremost, as soon as it happened, I knew that the response would largely come from people who have never said anything about anti-Semitism in their lives. It would come from people who were for the Washington team to keep their name. It would come from people who defended the Confederate flag at NASCAR. It wouldn't come from where it would need to come from, and that's inside the movement itself. And that was the other part that was really disheartening, because if we're going to take on anti-Semitic ideas, if we're going to take on racist ideas, if we're going to take on anti-immigrant ideas, any ideas that are inside a movement that are backward, that hold people back, that keep people divided, it has to come from inside that movement itself. So when you have folks like Dwayne Wade, whose instinct is to either cheer people on or defend them from being piled on too, it only serves to disrupt, disengage, and divide people.
So Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was in the middle of the civil rights movement, because some of the things happening right now, David, they seem so familiar, right? Because the divisions between Jews marched, they were disproportionately the group of white people that marched with civil rights. And so when this specific division happens the way that it does, and you're seeing the media cover it, how do you think we do in this regard?
I don't think it's done great, because I feel like there's an inordinate amount of attention. Anti-Semitism becomes like catnip when it can be placed on the black athlete or on black people. And there's very little discussion about it when it comes from official people in government. When Donald Trump stands with preachers who've said that Jewish people are going to hell, or when Representative Matt Gaetz brings a Holocaust denier to the State of the Union. I mean, that stuff, it's sort of like maybe it's a tweet, but then it's forgotten about the next day. But when it's rooted in the black community, anti-Semitism, and I would argue that anti-Semitism is rooted in every community, but when it shows itself inside the black community, and particularly inside movements for black liberation, it all of a sudden becomes something that's highlighted to a greater degree. And I have no problem with it being highlighted, discussed, debated, and hopefully crushed, because I don't want these ideas out there for myself, for my kids, et cetera. But I think those arguments need to come from people who are saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, and it's like Kareem's argument. I thought Kareem's piece was great, that says, wait a minute, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We either need to link our arms and move forward, or, you know, divided we fall. We're not going to make it. Like, we need much more of those arguments coming from the ranks of sports, coming from the ranks of athletes, coming from the ranks of people who have a vested interest in this new movement of, whether you want to call it player empowerment or using sports to stand up against racism. Like, those need to be the first people who stand up and say, you know, these ideas will not be tolerated. They also need to be the people to say, look, I'm not going to cancel Steven Jackson. I'm not going to cancel DeSean Jackson. People have the capacity to change, but for people to change, you have to actually challenge them. Otherwise, we're complicit in their bad ideas.
So what Kareem wrote, for those of you who do not know, and Kareem is actually, again, this goes back 50 years. He was in the middle of it a long time ago. What he wrote is, injustice for one is injustice for all. And so if you're outraged by the things happening to black people, then also be outraged by the anti-Semitism that makes Jewish people historically be allies with black people, because they're the communities that know oppression best. So when you see, Dave, that you're a guy who wrote a book with John Carlos, when you see that Kareem is still out here, this is bleeping 50 years later, Dave, and he's still got to make the same damn arguments he was making in the 60s.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, in Kareem's autobiography, Giant Steps, he talks about how he had to confront his own anti-Semitism, because when you're growing up in Harlem, as he was, he's trying to figure out, why is my community so divided? Why is it so difficult to find jobs? Why is police brutality so prevalent? And one of the reasons on a street level being given out to people is, well, it's the Jews who are destroying the black community, dividing the black community. And so when people hold out false explanations for what's happening, they can seem really attractive when you're desperate. And Kareem talks about how he works through those ideas and found a greater truth away from anti-Semitism. But it's like, imagine if he'd been canceled at that time. I mean, it's been so important that we hold out ideas of liberation that say you can reject anti-Semitism and keep fighting alongside us, but we're not going to do that by just saying, hey, no pile on, leave Nick Cannon alone. And you know, that's just not going to answer the call for the times that we're facing right now.
Dave Zirin with us here on ESPN Radio. Dave, I'm wondering, how much do you think the perception of all Jews are rich, they have wealth, they have power, how much do you think that factors into the lack of coverage and understanding of anti-Semitism?
Hugely. And I would just say it's the stereotype thereof, of Jews as having power and wealth and all the rest of it. I mean, which, you know, I could do with some power and wealth. You know, when people talk about their being a Jewish conspiracy, I always wonder why I'm not being invited to the meetings. But, you know, this is something that goes back, God, I mean, centuries. It's why my grandparents left Eastern Europe and Russia. Like, this idea that there was poverty, there was chaos, there was oppression, and because the answer by people in power, by Russian czars, was blame the Jews, a lot of Jews got on boats and came to the United States because to find some measure of not just religious freedom, but freedom from persecution and violence. And so, I mean, these ideas, they're so old, and yet they always seem to find new currency when people feel desperate because they're desperately looking for explanations for what's happening. And then you have utter thieves, people with no moral standing whatsoever, willing to put out those scapegoating ideas. And as I said, it's not exclusive to Jews. We see it with immigrants. We see it with calling this pandemic a Chinese virus. Like, this is an old tool. And I think what I'm hopeful is that we have a new generation of people who are intolerant of intolerance and are willing to reject this out of hand.
Dave, stay there. I'd like to talk to you a little more about this. We come back with Dave Zirin of The Nation in a moment.
ESPN Radio is presented by Progressive Insurance. Today on ESPN Daily, when a kid from Hershey, Pennsylvania transferred to English soccer club Chelsea FC, he became the most expensive American soccer player ever. Sam Borden tells the story of America's first global soccer star. That's on ESPN Daily. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Dave Zirin, nice enough to stay with us here for a second segment. And he continues with us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line.
Stan Van Gundy, in about 15 minutes, we will make fun of him mercilessly for 188 tweets in 4 days. you mentioned Dave Zirin of The Nation. I want to get back to what we were talking about. But before we do that, I'm curious for your thoughts on everything happening around the Washington football team.
Yeah, this is where I live. Dan Snyder is someone I've covered for 15 years, and I'm like everybody else. I'm waiting for this shoe to drop. I mean, there's always been this idea with Dan Snyder that there's something ugly underneath. It's like in Blue Velvet where they find the ear in the front lawn, if you remember that scene, where there's everything seems kind of peaceful, but
Jesus, Dave,
bad bubbling.
Jesus, Dave,
I know,
come on. I mean, Blue Velvet,
sorry.
No, I'm not even objecting to the ear in the lawn, that you're referencing a movie from the 80s.
Yeah, I am. Dennis Hopper, Kyle MacLachlan, great, great cast. Laura Dern.
All-time
crush. But it's just to say that this move isn't going to be good. But if it is going to mean the end of Dan Snyder's reign of error in Washington, people will be dancing in the streets.
So let's discuss what we were discussing. If you're not familiar with it, Dave Zirin of The Nation is with us, and Deshaun Jackson and Steven Jackson, said anti-Semitic things on social media. Yesterday, Dwayne Wade stepped in it and tried to clarify it, saying he was just supporting Nick Cannon's career, not his comments. But what should the punishments feel like? Is the public shame enough? Because the public shame is pretty unpleasant.
No, and I think the public shame is part of what people who otherwise would say something against anti-Semitism, they sometimes pull away. Like, I've spoken to some former NBA players who are very active on this issue of social justice, and they haven't said anything about Steven Jackson because they don't want to look like they're part of some kind of pile-on or public shaming because they think he needs some sort of defense. And I say to them, you're doing him no favors. And you're doing the movement no favors because you need to be able to show that inside the movement you're taking on these kinds of ideas. But I think what would be great to see would be someone taking them aside who they actually trust and saying, we need to actually debate this and discuss this. And a lot of that work needs to go on behind the scenes. I'm worried that work isn't going to happen in 2020 because there's not a lot of space for that kind of dialogue, it feels like sometimes. But I think of someone like Timmy Hardaway, who said things that were very anti-LGBTQ, and then he got a huge public shaming for it, and then he went about actually educating himself and started to do some of the work behind the scenes to actually help that cause. And I think that's in a lot of ways a good example, and not coincidentally, it's a pre-Twitter, pre-social media example of somebody taking the criticism seriously and then trying to change himself.
As someone who references 1980 movies and someone who knows and writes about the history of the civil rights movement and sports, can you help us understand And this is a difficult question to answer. The relationship with between blacks and Jews, it has been an allyship in many circumstances, but there have also been many circumstances where someone like Farrakhan is out there espousing anti-Semitic ideas.
It's incredibly a complicated relationship because you've got the experience of oppression that Jews had from the moment, first of all, from Eastern European Jews specifically, and then coming to this country. And then having to wrestle with a lot of the same issues that African-Americans were dealing with. And then there was this, so there was a kinship, a very real kinship that showed itself in the civil rights movement, in the freedom rides with, as you mentioned, a disproportionate number of Jewish people taking part in the desegregation struggles of the 50s and 60s. There's also another side to it as well, where a lot of businesses in black communities were owned by Jewish families who lived in those inner city neighborhoods and then left those neighborhoods but kept the businesses. So when there was this idea of who do we blame for, you know, for rats in our buildings, for greedy landlords, for things that are affecting people's lives, the immediate face of capital, if you will, the immediate face of oppression right in front of you was a local business owner and not a banker, and that local business owner was often Jewish. So there's been this built-in tension and kinship that's really unlike two other ethnic groups in the United States.
Dave, thank you for being on with us. We always appreciate the insight. Go check out his article, The Nation. He's the sports editor. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
So, Stugatz, that was slightly better than you and I did in the 3 days that we were talking about this.
Well, he's slightly smarter than I am, so.
No, me too, and he's certainly more informed on this subject than I am. So we will talk to Stan Van Gundy in a second. He is more informed than us on most subjects. But Chris Cody's afraid because he doesn't want to mock. He's afraid to mock, you know, the credible Stan Van Gundy. But I will. 188 tweets in 4 days is a lonely bored man, starved for attention. And we will mock him and his mustache next.